Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, voters in more than a dozen states cast ballots in Super Tuesday primaries, what the results could mean for November's presidential matchup.
The families of Israelis taken captive by Hamas on October 7th offer different perspectives on a potential hostage deal.
And what's behind the shocking increase in alcohol-related deaths in the U.S., and what can be done to stop it?
Those who use it don't think of themselves as using a drug, and therefore they don't worry about it as much as they should.
Welcome to the NewsHour. It is the biggest night of the primary election season. Voters in 16 states and one territory are making their picks for the Democratic and Republican nominees for president.
In a high-stakes election year, with an array of domestic and foreign issues at top of mind, voters today were weighing their options carefully.
I want to vote for Trump because I think he's conservative. He was pro-life.
Joe Biden. Overall, I think he done a great job regardless of what people think of his age.
I don't want to have Donald Trump as the option on the Republican ticket, so.
Well, I'm going to vote for anybody who says they're closing the border.
Non-committed, yeah. I am very concerned and about this election. I don't feel like we have equitable choices.
To help us make sense of it all, we're joined now by Republican strategist Kevin Madden, Democratic strategist Faz Shakir, and Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter, with a welcome to all of you. Amy, luckily for us, this is known as Super Tuesday and not Suspenseful Tuesday.
That's right.
Because the outcome of these primaries are widely expected to just move Joe Biden and Donald Trump
closer
to a November rematch.
That's right.
Still, though, what are you watching for?
Well, what the margins are is going to be somewhat interesting. I mean, we've seen from the very beginning of this process on the Republican side, Donald Trump go from 51% to 53% to 68%. In some polls that we've seen in these Super Tuesday states, he's getting over 70% of the vote. So the consolidation does seem complete. There are going to be a couple of states we'll be watching that are traditionally more blue, where independent voters can show up to vote. And we may see that Nikki Haley has a stronger night there, but not enough to put a meaningful dent in the momentum that Trump has built up.
Kevin, weigh in on that now. Let's take a look at the latest delegate count on the Republican side. As Jeff mentioned there, Mr. Trump is well on his way to securing that 1215 needed to secure the Republican nomination there. But he does still face a challenger in Nikki Haley, one we should mention who's not facing 91 charges on four criminal cases. Could we see voters' concern over that show up today?
Well, so far we have not seen it. I think a lot of the, in a primary context, the Trump's legal problems have actually had a Republican antibody effect in the sense that they've rallied the strongest base MAGA voter to his defense. So, but that's in a primary context. And so I think after tonight, we'll see that Donald Trump will probably, as a mathematical certainty, be the nominee, and Nikki Haley will have a mathematical impossibility to the nomination. But I think we'll also see the continued challenges that Donald Trump faces in a general election. So tonight I'm going to be watching, you know, some of these suburb areas in places like Virginia and North Carolina, places that have traditionally been the battleground areas of battleground states. And if we still see Trump struggle with those voters, Republican-leaning, pragmatic, independent-minded Republicans, he's going to need those voters that are now voting for Nikki Haley. He's going to need them in the general election if he's going to beat Joe Biden and he's going to win the Electoral College to become the next president.
And fast 4 years ago, now President Biden, he won 10 out of the 14 contests on Super Tuesday, a strong showing. Today, he's expected to sweep the entire thing as the incumbent. Still, though, what might we learn about his strengths and weaknesses as a candidate?
We're trying to still see whether there's voter intensity for Joe Biden. In order to win, he's got to have a record turnout like he had in 2020. According to a recent New York Times poll, you see some drop-off of his own voter base. People indicating, at least according to that poll, maybe only 80 to 83%, 85% are sticking with him, those who voted in 2020 for Joe Biden. that number has to be much higher. For Donald Trump, it's actually 97%. Those people who voted for him are indicating a high intensity of staying with him. The presence of Nikki Haley could have some significance here. If she continues on in this race, as we saw last time, she triggers Donald Trump. I mean, he spent a lot of time calling her bird brain, attacked her husband, you know, attacked her identity and her birth name. I think he's wanted her out of the race, and the longer she stays in it, triggers him. And I think it triggers him in an unhealthy way where he continues to affirm to a lot of these voters that Kevin was talking about that he ain't for them. And so that's the biggest question of tonight. If does Nikki Haley choose to stay in, and if he does, how she triggers Donald Trump in his worst elements.
Amy, we heard from some of those voters there talking about what matters to them, what's animating them to the polls. State by state here, what are you going to be watching for in terms of the issues that will either drive turnout or kind of keep people unenthused and staying home?
Well, in a number of these states, we also have congressional primaries. In Alabama is a good example of this. The courts determined that the state will now have two majority black districts. And so there, for the very first time, voters in this one district get their own representative. So you may see, you know, turnout up in some places because of the competitive races lower on the ballot rather than the usually it's the top of the ticket that's driving people out to vote. We have competitive races in California. We have competitive races in North Carolina in primaries. So I think those things I'm watching as well, because it's going to tell us, since so many of these districts are overwhelmingly red or overwhelmingly blue, it's going to tell us a lot more about what the next Congress could look like, because these folks, for them, this is the most competitive contest they'll have. By the time November comes around, it'll be a foregone conclusion. They'll be coming to Congress. And so we get a pretty good snapshot or a look into what the kind of people coming into Congress will be talking about.
Kevin, we will see how much longer Nikki Haley stays in this race after tonight. If she drops out soon, where do her voters go, do you think?
Well, I think they park themselves in undecided. And that'll be the big charge and the big challenge that Donald Trump has from here all the way to November, is can he turn those voters who right now are registering support for Nikki Haley and a sort of a protest against Donald Trump, and whether or not he can eventually by November get them to hold their nose and say, okay, I don't necessarily like Donald Trump, but he's better than Joe Biden. And that'll be the big challenge for him from here all the way to November.
That, speaking of the protest vote, we did see that protest vote when it came to President Biden in Michigan. Over 100,000 people showing up to vote uncommitted in protest of President Biden's handling of Israel's war in Gaza. Do we expect to see more of that today?
Oh, for sure, yeah. You'll see it in Minnesota and a few other places where there will people will be casting this uncommitted vote, and that we should all know and understand a couple of things about it. One is, we want in a democracy people to be voting and expressing their pain and angst, and right now it gives Joe Biden, quite frankly, the time to address it. And the only way he can address it is by changing policy. And he's got an opportunity to do that coming up on Thursday. He's got a State of the Union. By all accounts, he's working very hard on trying to get a ceasefire deal, a six-week ceasefire deal that could be game-changing for at least trying to move towards some resolution of the conflict and end it. But nothing's going to change for Joe Biden until he can show a policy change. And I know that they're breaking their necks to try to figure that out. And meanwhile, voters are kind of continually going to put a political pressure on the system, as they should, to see a change happen.
And Amy, quickly, unrelated to Super Tuesday, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced today that she's not seeking re-election. What does that do to the Senate landscape?
Well, this seat was already going to be very, very competitive. What we see now is a battleground state with very clear Democrat or Republican, but those Democrat and Republican, very different from the types that have come before them. They don't come from the moderate lane. They come more from the more progressive and more conservative lane. So winning over independent voters is going to be a challenge for both of them for different reasons.
And her exit is Ruben Gallego's gain, the Democrat in that race?
Theoretically, although she was also, Sinema, that is, taking a lot of Republican votes as well from those kinds of voters that Kevin was talking about, who in the era of Trump feel like they don't have a home, and Sinema's independence was attractive to them.
Amy Walter, Faz Shakir, and Kevin Madden, our thanks to all three of you.
Well, one of the most watched non-presidential races of the day is in California.
Voters there are deciding who should fill a U.S. Senate seat. And as Laura Barrón López explains, today's primary will determine whether the race is just the beginning or essentially the end.
Super Tuesday's blockbuster drama will be in California, where 11 Democrats and 10 Republicans are competing for the state's open Senate seat. Only the top two finishers, regardless of party, will remain in the race.
I am still doing my homework. I'm not completely ready to decide who my next senator is going to be.
For Democrats, there are three leading contenders, all self-described progressives already serving in the House.
This will set a new precedent.
Adam Schiff is best known for trying former President Trump's first impeachment trial.
I think Californians are looking for a senator who leads in the big fights when our democracy was at risk, when we had a man who would be a dictator as president. I was in the center of that fight, protecting our institutions.
This all totals up to $1,000.
Katie Porter became a viral sensation with her pointed whiteboard interrogations in committee.
I went in really prepared, asking tough questions of people like bank CEOs about why their workers can't put food on the table, asking tough questions, and more importantly, getting answers. And I think that's a really important part of the Senate and the House that, frankly, we aren't seeing Democrats or Republicans do enough of.
I rise today really with a very heavy heart.
Barbara Lee's national profile dates back to a vote she cast more than 22 years ago.
This unspeakable act on the United States has really forced me, however, to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God.
The only lawmaker who opposed authorizing military force in the days immediately following 9/11.
I voted against that, and I said it could escalate out of control, and it did.
Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1 here in California. But with the party's vote split between three well-known candidates and low expected turnout, a Republican could make it through to November.
We need to build consensus now more than ever. It makes me think, hasn't anybody played a team sport in Congress?
Former L.A. Dodger and Republican frontrunner Steve Garvey leans on sports metaphors while claiming moderate conservative principles. But the first-time candidate offers few specifics or a concrete policy platform, saying he's just trying to listen right now.
We're in a time where people are very angry with the issues. They're angry about homelessness, they're angry about crime, they're angry about the economy, and they're angry about the border. And that creates an environment where an outsider with common sense solutions like Steve Garvey can be heard and be an effective candidate.
Keith Curry, the former Republican mayor of Newport Beach, is backing Garvey.
There's no doubt that it's difficult for a Republican running statewide in California.
Curry says star power can elevate California Republicans, like it did for Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger. But Curry never supported Donald Trump. And Garvey won't say who he's backing for president this year.
Steve Garvey voted for Trump twice. Is that a problem for you at all?
Most Republicans voted for Donald Trump. And, you know, he's probably going to be the nominee this year. He's not very popular in California. But he's going to be the nominee.
Garvey didn't respond to our request for an interview. Over the weekend, Garvey surged in a new UC Berkeley poll from a virtual tie for second place with Congresswoman Katie Porter to a statistical dead heat for first with Congressman Adam Schiff.
Two leading candidates for Senate. Two very
Garvey's rise follows massive
California.
Ad buys from
Steve
Schiff
Garvey,
during the closing weeks, painting the Republican as his main competitor.
He's attacking me repeatedly on Fox, and in a jungle primary, you can't ignore one of your leading opponents who's attacking you.
This is a huge choice for Californians.
Porter believes Schiff is boosting Garvey to guarantee a win for himself in November.
Eric Early proudly stands with Donald Trump.
She's buying ads that say another Republican, Eric Early, is the true MAGA threat.
I don't think anyone should think that Steve Garvey's going to be California's next senator, but having him in this race all the way through November is a huge, huge gift to Republicans.
For most Democratic voters, the candidates differ more in personality than policy.
It will be hard for me to differentiate. A lot of the times it feels like I'm just tossing a coin in a bucket.
Picking the right person feels really important, and it's pretty tough to narrow it down.
Many of their policies are the same. It's hard sometimes to tell where they overlap and where they don't overlap.
All three candidates support Medicare for All, have proposals to reduce the cost of housing, support abolishing the filibuster, and all three are worried about young voters' disillusionment with President Joe Biden and their party.
I want to make sure that young people know that their voices are being heard.
Right now in our U.S. Senate, we don't have nearly enough younger voices.
If I have a concern, it's about the youth vote.
Yeah.
In the final stretch, they're fighting to separate themselves from the pack.
I'm drawing the contrast with my Democratic colleagues based on leadership and effectiveness.
Porter says she's immune to big money's influence, refusing to accept cash from corporations or lobbyists.
In my time in Congress, in my 5 years there, I've done Congress differently.
Lee had to fight her high school's administration before earning a spot as the first Black woman on the cheerleading team. And unlike her opponents, she's experienced living unhoused.
We have families that can't afford childcare. I know what that's like. I've lived that.
If Democrats finish in first and second place, the race to November will be competitive.
I voted for Steve Garvey.
And why'd you vote for Garvey?
Because I'm really tired of the Democratic policies.
But if voters pick a Democrat and a Republican, November will be almost certainly sewn up for the Democrat that makes it through. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barrón-López.
And we'll have more live coverage of Super Tuesday online and later tonight, beginning at 11 p.m. Eastern, right here on PBS.
In the day's other headlines, Ukraine claimed it sank a Russian warship, the third in recent weeks, with a high-tech sea drone. Kyiv's military intelligence agency said it happened in the Kerch Strait, linking Russia to the Crimean Peninsula. Ukrainian video purportedly showed an explosion tearing into a Russian patrol ship. The vessel was part of Russian defenses against drone attacks. The International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for two top Russian commanders today for their actions in Ukraine. The warrants charge Sergei Kobylash and Viktor Sokolov with directing attacks on electric power sites and with crimes against humanity. Ukrainian officials welcomed the move.
It's not only about war crime, it's about crimes against humanity, because these crimes were committed on massive scale, and these attacks were committed far beyond the front line, with no any potential even military reason.
Moscow does not recognize the court's jurisdiction and is expected to not hand over the generals for trial. China has set an ambitious economic growth target of 5% this year. It comes despite lagging demand, deflation, and a real estate debt crisis. The National People's Congress, that's the country's rubber stamp legislature, listened today as the Chinese premier laid out the spending plan and acknowledged the difficulties ahead.
The complexity, severity, and uncertainty of the external environment are increasing. The foundation for China's sustained economic recovery is not yet stable, with insufficient effective demand, overcapacity in some industries, weak social expectations, and still many risks and hidden dangers.
The budget also includes a 7% hike in defense spending. China's overall military budget has more than doubled in the last decade. Back in this country, Liberty University will pay a $14 million federal fine for not reporting data about crimes on its Lynchburg, Virginia campus. It's the largest fine ever under a law that mandates collecting crime information and alerting students. Liberty is one of the world's largest Christian schools with more than 15,000 students. The men's basketball team at Dartmouth voted today to form the first labor union for college athletes. Players said the age of amateurism is over. The school said academics, not athletics, are paramount for Ivy League students, so there's no cause to unionize. Dartmouth could file a legal challenge to the move. The Biden administration is proposing a new ceiling for credit card late fees. The president announced it today as he met with his so-called competition council. Fees would be topped at $8 per transaction. Currently, they average $32. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said it will sue to block the rule. And on Wall Street, weak economic data and a slide in big tech stocks drove the market downward. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 404 points to close at 38,585. The NASDAQ fell 268 points. The S&P 500 dropped 52. Still to come on the NewsHour, journalist Kara Swisher discusses her new book on her life and her complicated relationship with the tech industry. And a theater company in Texas that's promoting and preserving Latin American culture and history.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz is still in Washington today, meeting with top U.S. officials, including Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. His trip comes as negotiators met for a second day in Cairo, working towards a deal between Israel and Hamas to pause fighting in Gaza and free Israeli hostages. But so far, there's been no breakthrough. Nick Schifrin looks at the status of the talks and speaks to two hostage family members.
Negotiations between Israel and Hamas are at a critical moment. U.S. officials tell me that Hamas has responded to the most recent outline that would pause the war for 6 weeks for the release of 35 to 40 hostages, but it will take some time for Israel and international mediators to reply. The U.S. had hoped to secure a deal before the Islamic holy month of Ramadan begins next week. Today, once again, President Biden put the onus on Hamas.
It's in the hands of Hamas right now. The Israelis have been cooperating. There's an offer out there that's rational. We don't know what we'll know in a couple days if it's going to happen. But we need the ceasefire.
Central to that ceasefire are the lives of 100 or so Israeli hostages who've been held in Gaza for nearly 5 months and their families waiting for their release. But not all the families agree on how to best bring their loved ones back home. I'm first joined by Yair Glick, the cousin of Eitan Moore, who was a security guard at the Nova Festival when Hamas terrorists launched their assault. Thank you very much, Yair Glick. Welcome to the NewsHour. I appreciate it. Do you believe, bottom line, that if a deal is possible this week, the Israeli government should accept it?
Hi, thank you for having me. No, I think that we should not have a deal with terrorists. We should not negotiate with them. We want them all back. We want all our families come back, but we think that we need to do it in a different way.
So what is that different way? What do you believe is the best way to get Eitan Moore back?
We need to make Hamas, the terrorists that attack Israel, kidnap people, torture people, murder people. We need to force them to give all the people back. We cannot let these terrorists to get what they want and what they did it for.
Do you believe that the way the Israeli government is going about the campaign in Gaza, do you believe that that is beginning to force Hamas to do, as you say, to avoid giving in to Hamas demands?
Yes, we can see that we are really continue to fight Hamas and we are winning there. We are forcing them to go back and to hide, and we need just to continue it. We don't want the terrorists to be there. We don't want terrorists to be able to do again this terrible attacks. And we can continue doing it and trying all the time, of course, to take care of the people in Gaza.
And what do you say to the people who point out that the IDF has managed to release a few hostages, but the vast majority of hostages who have been released came during a ceasefire that the Israeli government accepted back in November when more than 100 hostages were released?
So first, I think that we should look on the differences between the deals. So during November, we get 1 week of ceasefire. Now they're offering 6 weeks to give us less people. During this time, they add time to get more weapon, more ammo. These kind of deals will just give them more will to do it again and again.
The argument you're making is echoed by the Tikva Forum, a group of families that was created by Eitan's father. Many other families believe that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not doing enough to prioritize the securing of hostages. Do you believe that you're in the minority?
I think that yes, because when you're talking about families of hostages, I think that the rational and the normal reaction will be to do whatever they need to get them back. And I can't judge them, and I really understand them. But I'm not talking about the families. I'm talking about the country. I'm talking about the decision makers. And they need to think in a different way. They need to be rational, not emotional. So we need to think about the future. We need to think what will happen next time.
And finally, Eitan Moore, your cousin, is 23 years old. What should we know about him?
So he's really young man that's just starting his life. He's turning from teenage to a man, and he moved to his own apartment and start thinking about studying, learning what to do. And now this terrible thing happened, and we need to talk about how to get him out of Gaza.
Yair Glick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we turn to Jonathan Dekel Chen. His son, Sagi, was kidnapped by Hamas terrorists from kibbutz near Oz, where one in four people were either killed or kidnapped on October the 7th. Jonathan Dekel Chen, thank you so much. Welcome back to the NewsHour. As I've just laid out, there is a deal that Israel and Hamas are negotiating that would stop the war for about 6 weeks, at least in the first round, for the release of 35 to 40 hostages or so. Do you believe the Israeli government, bottom line, should accept that deal?
I believe the Israeli government should be doing its job and returning as many of the hostages as possible in as early time frame as possible. Right now, we don't know how many are still alive. Every day, every hour, the possibility increases that there are fewer of them to return alive. So, yes, I'm absolutely in favor of it.
Do you believe the Israeli government right now is doing all it can to release your son and the remaining hostages?
You know, it's hard for me to give you a solid answer on that. We will only know that they've done everything that they must do when all of the hostages that are alive and the bodies, unfortunately, of those that we already know Hamas is holding, when they all return home. That will be the sign that the Israeli government has done all that it must to bring back these people and not sacrifice them a second time after October 7th.
The Israeli government and its supporters have argued that military pressure needs to increase in order to convince Hamas to release the hostages. Do you agree?
Unfortunately, I don't. I mean, the Israeli soldiers, these are my brothers, my sons, and I completely support what they are trying to do. However, there's no proof of concept that military action is going to get any of the hostages home alive. The three hostages that were rescued by the IDF are the exception that proves the rule. And the rest of the, we hope, 130-something hostages are being held very closely by Hamas in the tunnels. And so this idea that Israeli soldiers are going to go knocking on Sinwar's door and he will then turn over the hostages, it's fantasy. There's absolutely no proof. And on the contrary, there's proof that before giving them up, the Hamas leadership will, in all probability, execute them all. So, no, absolutely, I do not support that idea that military action, prioritized or certainly on its own, is going to get even one hostage home alive.
Do you believe that you represent the vast majority of the families of those being held in Gaza?
Absolutely. There's no question. Also, the vast majority of the people of Israel. We see that in the streets. We see that in the press. There's no question that Israelis understand that we simply cannot be whole again after the disaster of October 7th, a disaster overseen by our own government. We can only be whole again when the hostages come home. We won't be able to look at each other if, God forbid, the hostages are not returned alive or those whose bodies remain in Gaza for them to be returned.
On October the 7th, your son fought off Hamas terrorists trying to protect his wife and two daughters. Your daughter-in-law has subsequently had a baby. She was pregnant on October the 7th. What do you want people to know about your son?
Well, my son is the kind of guy where not just our community, our kibbutz community, not just our country, but I really do believe that, you know, large parts of the world can benefit by people like that being active parts of this world, of doing good, of creating, of constructing. And that is my son in a nutshell. And you're right, the time has come for him to be reunited now with his three daughters and his wife. His wife is truly the hero of our family story, both surviving an impossible ordeal on October 7th and keeping the lives of her daughters moving forward despite this utterly impossible situation that we find ourselves in.
Jonathan Dekel Chen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Few journalists have been covering Silicon Valley as long as Kara Swisher, and even fewer are as respected, liked, and feared by the tech industry and its most iconic leaders. For the first time, she's opening up about her own life in her latest book, which we recently discussed, entitled Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. Kara Swisher, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I think it's fair to say that you don't mince words and you don't suffer fools.
I don't.
You call
right,
it
correct.
As you
check.
See it, in particular with people in positions of power. And in your memoir, it seems like you've always been that way, even when you were a kid. You were unafraid to question authority. I'm wondering where that comes from, but also how you hang on to that over the years in a world that often kind of squashes that in women.
It does. I don't know. I don't know what's happened here. It just won't stop. I was like this as a kid. My nickname as a baby was Tempesta. You know, and of course, that's the name they would put on a woman, right? Like, ooh, difficult, bossy. I used to get bossy all the time. And I was like, I'm just have executive function. You know, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know. I just am the way I am. And I kind of get irked when people just tell you or explain things. I'm not one that's easily mansplained at kind of thing. And so I just was always like, why? Why was my favorite word? And over the years, you know, persistent obnoxiousness has been a career highlight for me.
Well, it's a good question to be asking in journalism in particular. And you joined the journalism world early. I do want to point out journalism was not your first choice for careers, right?
No, I wanted to be in the military. My dad was in the military, who had died many years before. And I was very, I usually wanted to do that. I thought it was important to serve your country. I wanted to do military intelligence. I was very interested in, I thought about the CIA. I thought about State Department, all those places. But I was really oriented toward the military, but I was gay. And at the time, you could not be gay and be in the military. And it took a very long time and a ridiculous amount of so many good people could have served. I would have been an admiral, and I think I would have done a very nice job.
You mentioned your father. You were very young. You were just 5 years old, right? How you look back on that now, the impact of losing your father that early on who you are now, on how you live now, on how you parent now?
Well, you know, there's not a day that goes by I don't think about my dad. This is some, you know, 50 some years hence. And I think about him all the time. He was the most important, one of the more, you know, when a parent dies at a young age, half your life goes away, right? Like, so you have two parents, many people, not everybody does, but it's a real blow. And I didn't realize the disaster of it, for me at least. Because what happens is you often get very, it's called highly functional, and you're like, I can do it, I'm fine. Everything bad happened, and I'm fine. Mm. And so you get really good at running through roadblocks, essentially. But when I had my first guy, I have four kids now, but when I had my son, and I remember when he turned five, which is around the age my dad died, he knew me so well. And I was like, oh, my God, it really was someone I was very close to died. And you don't have memories or ability to express things as well at five. So it's informed everything I've done. And it's made me realize more than most people that life is too short. And that's a cliche. But I don't got any kind of time for nonsense. I think that's what it brings to me.
I was interested to learn in your academic career when you were studying at Georgetown, your focus in history classes in particular was on Nazi propaganda. And you wrote in your book, what struck me was how easily people could be manipulated by fear and rage and how facts could be destroyed without repercussions. How much of a parallel do you see between what we are living today and what you were studying back then?
It's the same thing. You know, they call it misinformation, disinformation, digital, you know, all kinds of bots. It's propaganda. And so now and especially since we're addicted to these devices, it gets even worse. So I say this a lot, like Hitler didn't need Instagram, right? Or Mussolini didn't need, you know, Snapchat. But can you imagine if they had these devices? Very problematic. And they did fine with just paper or radio or whatever. So did many other, you know, terrible leaders over the course of history. But this presents tools to people who are bad on a global level at a scale that is unprecedented.
In your career, you've covered, gotten to know, interviewed some of the world's most powerful tech leaders, mostly men, I think it's fair to say. I'm curious over time if you have found that they all have one thing in common. Is there something that stood out to you?
Besides being straight white men, let's see. They have different versions of this, but persistence, the ability to persist despite mistakes, right? To be able to pivot very quickly, to be able to sort of believe the unbelievable, and that's a good part, but it can also be a bad part, right? If you are like, I'm going to do it anyway. But the really good ones, they have that ability to keep going no matter what and believe the unbelievable, but then pivot when they need to.
Your book is, as you say, a tech love story. And I think tech has undoubtedly made our lives better in so many ways, but there are so many risks and dangers, and those are real. And I wonder what you make of the efforts to try to control those, lawmakers in particular trying to regulate them, pressure on tech leaders to have morality infused in their decisions. I mean, how do we get rid of the risks and dangers and still have the benefits?
Well, we haven't tried because it hasn't worked. We haven't done anything. So, I mean, if there was one law, if you could name a law for me that protects us against technology specifically, you can't find it. The law that exists actually benefits them. Section 230, it gives them broad immunity. They can't be sued. You know, you can't have the biggest industry in the world in terms of value and power not have any liability. It'd be unimaginable if it was pharmaceuticals or insurance or Wall Street. But here we are.
You quote the line in your book, Babylon was, meaning every major power at some point will meet its end. Do you think the same was going to happen to the giants in tech?
One of the things about tech is the young tends to eat its old. Although in this new shift to AGI, artificial general intelligence, it's dominated by big companies and companies that have been around, whether it's Microsoft or Meta or Amazon. And of course, Alphabet, Google. So it's still dominated by the big players because it's so costly. The cost of compute here is so high. And so right now, it's kind of an interesting shift. The younger companies, of which they're getting funded, a ton of them, none of them has broken through to beat the bigger companies. And I doubt they will in this particular era.
All right. The book is Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. The author is Kara Swisher. Kara, thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
One of the most commonly used drugs in the U.S. is also one of the deadliest. That's alcohol. Over the last 20 years, more and more Americans have died from alcohol-related causes, and a new study reveals how those deaths have surged recently. William Brangham takes a closer look.
The CDC issued this new report, and it looks at both deaths directly tied to alcohol, like cirrhosis of the liver, as well as indirect deaths, like injuries and certain types of cancer. It found that in just 5 years, alcohol-related deaths rose by 29%. By 2021, alcohol contributed to the deaths of more than 178,000 Americans that year. That's about 500 people a day lost because of consuming wine, beer, or other alcohol. For a broader look at these findings, we're joined again by Keith Humphreys. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. Keith, very good to have you back on the NewsHour. Were you surprised? I mean, this is your field of study. Were you surprised by these numbers and how much they had ticked upwards?
Sadly, I am not. We noticed during the pandemic that certain groups of the population were increasing their drinking, including drinking alone and drinking in large amounts. And also, there's been a long-term trend, although cost of living is going up for many things, it is not for alcohol. Alcohol is very cheap in the United States right now in historical terms. And when it's cheap, Americans tend to drink more, and that's where you get, unfortunately, these kinds of really tragic numbers.
And are those the principal drivers, low price and all the stresses associated with the pandemic?
Those two things are absolutely critical to producing this kind of increase. I mean, we have, you know, federal alcohol taxes were last increased in 1991. They've been declining in real terms ever since. Alcohol taxes on craft beer and spirits were actually cut just before the pandemic. And that has always historically driven more consumption. The other point to remember, of course, is that alcohol is a legal product and therefore one that is heavily advertised. And we do know that the amount of promotion of alcohol, which anyone who has watched a football game is aware of, also helps keep the business flowing and keeps people drinking, including sometimes, unfortunately, too much.
I mean, I can't help but notice you and I have talked many times over the years, but we're always talking about illicit drugs, illegal drugs, and policies to address those, never about alcohol. I mean, is that just like, as Orwell says, that the struggle is constantly to see the thing that is right there in front of us?
It's a huge blind spot in American drug policy. You can talk about drugs for hours, and people will mention fentanyl and meth and cocaine, which are, of course, very important drugs to think about, and they do a lot of harm. But no one will bring up alcohol. And afterwards, they may all get a drink together and not even think, we're using a drug right now. And that's partly what the risk of alcohol comes from, is that those who use it don't think of themselves as using a drug, and therefore they don't worry about it as much as they should.
One of the things, back into the CDC's data, while more men died of alcohol-related deaths, the death rate increased for women quite dramatically. Why do you think that is?
Very tragic to see these increase among women's deaths, and also it's enraging to know where it comes from. So about 25 years ago, the alcohol industry observed that women were getting more education, more disposable income, but they weren't drinking that much. So they launched quite a bit of female-focused advertising, you know, creating, for example, you know, mommy wine culture and that sort of thing. And it worked, broadly speaking. We saw an increase in women's drinking, including in some populations drinking as much as men. And biologically, the same amount of alcohol in general actually is more damaging to women than men, partly to do for reasons of metabolism, partly to do with reasons of body size. And so we're seeing the, you know, the awful outcome of a, you know, 25-year-long campaign to get women to drink more heavily.
So in terms of solutions, what do we know that works on a policy level? I mean, you touched on some of these things, price being one of them, but what else can we do as a society to try to ameliorate these ills?
Yeah, sometimes the simple answer is the right one. You know, alcohol is a commodity, like gasoline. People use less of it when it's more expensive. So simply indexing alcohol taxes for inflation so they don't lose value over a year, that would reduce people's drinking. We have very good demonstrations of that fact in states and nations that have done it.
And what about individuals? If someone personally feels like, you know what, I am concerned about this, what do we know works?
So one thing I can say with optimism for anyone who's out there struggling with a drinking problem is there's about 23, 24 million Americans who have had a serious problem with alcohol or other drugs and are in recovery. Recovery is a realistic aspiration. It happens every single day. There's no one right pathway to it. There are people who benefit through Alcoholics Anonymous, the mutual help program. There's people who benefit from treatment, from counseling. There's people who benefit from medications. There's also people who are able to change without any of those things, usually with some reorientation in their life, like engaging with people who don't drink and activities that are incompatible with drinking. So there's every reason to believe that you can recover, and there's certainly no reason to feel ashamed if you have a drink problem. It's something that millions and millions of Americans will go through.
All right. Keith Humphreys of Stanford University, always so interesting to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back shortly with a look at an Austin, Texas theater company that's working to promote and preserve Latin American culture.
But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like this one on the air.
For those stations staying with us, off-the-shelf drones have proved to be a transformational technology, and now they're helping reunite us with man's best friend, as special correspondent Malcolm Brabin saw in southern England in this Encore report.
We've just driven for about 2.5 hours across the English countryside in southern England to a village called Wanston in the county of Hampshire. And we're joining people looking for a black Labrador called Xena, who's 1 year old and who's been missing for a few days. The drone pilots have been up. There have been some positive sightings. But Xena is a bit nervous and she took fright and disappeared. And there's only about an hour to go before nightfall. We're following actress Errol Holt, who became Xena's owner a month ago, after the young Labrador was rejected as a gun dog because she was easily spooked.
Unfortunately, somebody came round to visit and they had a very high-pitched voice, a very bumptious dog, and I think it was just the last straw for her. And I suddenly turned around, I went, where's the dog?
Earlier, the area was scanned by a drone that can detect the body heat of a scared puppy or an invading infantryman.
The Ukrainian government have purchased this particular model because of the thermal capabilities. So I've heard they're in very short supply at the moment. So I was luckily managed to get one about a year ago.
Shane Phillips is a commercial drone pilot who normally makes films, but volunteers for search and rescue when the call comes.
Dogs tend to hide in quite dense undergrowth. They're never usually out in the open. But with the drone, especially with thermal capabilities, you can clear the open very quickly. We can scan this whole field area here in a matter of seconds, and at least we can say there's no dog here, and you can focus your efforts elsewhere.
I'm very frightened for her, really, because she doesn't know this part of the country at all. She's only one. This is just the perfect place for her to be because there are no main roads around here at all. But if she was to stray further, we've got really, really busy roads. There's a railway line.
As the light fades fast, a farmer's convinced that he's spotted the Labrador.
It's definitely.
But the animal was a muntjac, a small deer about the same size as a dog. Zena faced her third night alone while her owner endured a tumult of anxiety and hope. Similar emotions flowed at the biggest reservoir in North Wales when a dog walker's idyllic country stroll went pear-shaped. Her charge, Charlie, a venerable spaniel, suddenly vanished into thin air.
As the evening went on and the night drew in, we became more and more anxious that we weren't going to find Charlie.
Charlie is the best friend Lydia David will ever have.
There was no way that we were leaving that night without him. It was an awful experience to go through, one that I wouldn't wish on anyone. We just wanted to get him back to where he belonged, back to the people that loved him, back to safety.
Launching.
Cometh the hour, cometh the drone pilot. Tim Smith spotted Lydia's SOS post in a Facebook dog search and rescue group.
And a lot of people consider drones to be a nuisance, but we actually use them to find lost dogs. And around here, particularly in the weather conditions in North Wales, a lost dog can be in a lot of trouble.
The odds weren't encouraging.
Charlie was deaf, blind, and almost lame. So a very elderly dog. To start with, nobody could understand what had happened because we covered the land and we actually flew over where Charlie was and nobody saw him.
But then the dog walker pointed to the place where Charlie disappeared. Tim reached for his thermal camera. The white dot in the middle shows Charlie trapped on the water's edge.
I've got him.
Charlie!
I've got him. I've got him.
Charlie!
We're so incredibly lucky that Tim saw that post that night, that he was able and happy to come out and help us. Everyone did as much as they could, and that's what got Charlie back home safe to us.
I came away on an incredible high. Yeah, I'm still buzzing.
These are just some of the dogs who've gone missing in the past couple of weeks. Every day, on average, there are 10 new appeals to track down a four-legged friend. The group can call on 2,500 drone pilots, and to date, they've reunited nearly 3,000 dogs with their families. Hope is running out in Cornwall, in southwest England, a landscape pitted with abandoned tin and copper mines. Douglas went missing after his owner went for a run.
I had him since I was, I think, 10 years old, and so he's basically grown up with us as kids.
Elodie Sparrow is a student of Mandarin and bereft.
He's been, you know, through really hard times in our life and he's been such a comfort and he's definitely a big part of the family.
This is Douglas in happier times near Elodie's home.
He's a 12-year-old Cocker Spaniel and he is quite infirm and he's blind and probably he's hard of hearing.
John Davis is a former police dog handler who takes to the air when the ground trail goes cold.
They're hiding, they're probably in the feral dog syndrome, the wild syndrome that they go into after a time of being out of their family. They're scared, they're frightened, they want to hunker down. Alas, at this point, we actually haven't found Douglas.
It feels really strange not to have him with us, but also it's horrible to have to worry about what could have happened to him.
Hello, Zena.
Back in Hampshire, after missing for 3.5 days, Zena made her own way back home, lured by a pile of scented clothes, including Errol's husband's dirty underwear.
We've got Zena home at last, which is really, really fantastic. She's very tired and she's had a good meal and now she's just nodding off on her favourite sofa.
Thank you.
No problem at all.
Ooh. Thank you
no
so
problem.
Much, honestly.
Anytime. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Hopefully never again.
Yes, hopefully never again.
But as Zina luxuriates in home comforts, spare a thought for those lost forever. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in southern England.
The Austin, Texas theater company Proyecto Teatro aims to promote and preserve Latin American culture, and its latest project is helping redefine Latin American history. Journey Love Taylor of our Student Reporting Labs Academy shares this story as part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
At the Vortex Theater in Austin, Texas, Proyecto Teatro is in the middle of rehearsal for Cabarex 2, the second installment of a trilogy of stage plays that explore Latin American history, from the times before the arrival of Columbus all the way through to an imagined future. Luis Armando Ordaz Gutierrez is the longtime artistic director for the company.
We're wanting to use this show to raise awareness of what we can do as a local community to take back our culture, to take back our art form and our identity.
But this isn't just a play. It's a cabaret, and it's performed completely in Spanish.
This type of work, you don't really see it so much in Spanish, and you don't see this type of work in the Latino community because cabaret is derived from European art forms, and so it's a little odd and a little different and new to see it in the context of our culture. And so when people saw it, they were just so happy to be able to see their stories, their people, their characters in the lens of cabaret with like the musical numbers and the dance sequences and the jazzy music.
My favorite part about being involved in this production specifically, I think, would be the dances. There's one with like chairs. We have to do a little like chair dance routine. I love that one.
Being a part of something so impactful in my community feels like a great responsibility, especially since I feel that I am a leader and someone who creates something for other people to see and other people that are not part of my culture to see, to make sure that what I'm doing always carries that intention that I want it to carry and the intention of respecting and honoring my culture.
I really don't get a chance to like connect with my roots. So being here and like Rachel like teaching us these indigenous dances, just like learning about the history, it's a really beautiful thing.
For the PBS NewsHour Student Reporting Labs, I'm Journey Love Taylor.
And don't forget to join us later tonight for our live Super Tuesday special. We'll have the latest results and analysis from today's Republican and Democratic presidential primaries. That's at 11 p.m. Eastern right here on PBS. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you later this evening.